jingo, won't you share our love? We will build for you a hut. You're gonna be our favorite nut. We'll have a lot of little low, by golly. Then we'll put them in the follies. By jingo, said by gosh, by gee. By Jiminy, please don't bother me. So they all went away singing, oh, by gee, by gosh, by
hello, and welcome to the American Writers 100 Pages at a Time podcast. And in this episode, we'll look at... We'll continue looking at Native Son by Richard Wright. Specifically, we'll finish up book two, Flight, and begin talking about book three, Fate, which will bring us to our final episode next time. So this episode is just sort of going to get us from like the middle part of the book to the end. It's kind of a bridge episode, I suppose. You know, it would have been nicer if this had just been divided into four parts, but, you know... I've kind of said most of what I need to say about section book two, Flight, thematically, what's going on there. Really, this, you know, we got about 30 or 40 pages left of this section, and it's really talking about Bigger Thomas's like arrest. But of course, one really important thing does happen, and that is, well, first, he's sort of identified as the suspect. Now, I love how book two waits to get there. I mean, it takes, you know, days for the police start to suspect Bigger Thomas, even though he was sort of just right there. And in hindsight, kind of an obvious suspect. He was seen publicly with them. He was with Jan and Mary. He, you know, had access, you know, he was supposed to pick her up in the morning, take her to Detroit. I mean, there's all this evidence that he was there, but he was so easily able to deflect the police by focusing, by redirecting it towards communism, you know, taking advantage of anti-communist feelings, but also, I think, racist ideas that someone like Bigger Thomas in his role would just be a subservient, dutiful servant to this white family that's been taking care of him. And then once the evidence is there that it was Bigger Thomas, right? Because they find like evidence in the coal furnace of bones and things like that of Mary, proving it had to have been someone in the home and it couldn't have been Jan. And so that leaves Bigger Thomas as the suspect. How the media shifts its narrative and how the police shift its narrative. Now, the communist aspect never really goes away. I mean, it's still an interesting aspect, especially in the third part of the book, where a lot of effort is put into it. And I think any modern adaptation of this, like the one I've mentioned before, can't really include this in the story quite as much. But I think it's important that it's there because that's part of the cultural context of the time, is, you know, what... how communists were one of the few anti-racist organizations out there, where you had white people like standing up for black people and defending them and trying to imagine a more anti-racist society, but at the same time not really achieving much for people like Bigger Thomas because they didn't fully understand them, right? There's a bit of white privilege in their ability to cross the veil. That someone like Bigger Thomas couldn't have. And that's what made him so uncomfortable about it. I love what's done with the communist here. Not just my own sympathies for them, but, you know, I think Richard Wright understood this aspect of the book in ways that maybe other writers couldn't or didn't, because he was attracted to communism. He was part of the movement, and he knew these kinds of people. And of course, he is someone who crossed the color line in his own marriages. So that's something to maybe keep in mind here too. And of course he flees to Paris, to where there would have been a stronger socialist communist movement too. Even though he kind of backs away from communism being a solution to the problem, we saw in Uncle Tom's Children him playing with that idea too. But there's no real gains in any of these books by the communists. It's just small victories here and there, but the bigger issue is their incapacity to actually achieve some kind of a true substantial gains for them. Now, obviously, this is a very pessimistic book. James Baldwin has his feelings about this, and we'll get to that in a few weeks when we start taking on James Baldwin. James Baldwin did not like this book for the way it presented black people. He calls it a protest novel that falls into the same traps of sentimentality that Uncle Tom's Cabin does. He actually compares the two. I think that's really unfair, I guess. I'll say more about it then. I think he's a bit... he's just wrong about this book, I think. But it is, though, a protest novel. But that's not a bad thing, necessarily. I guess that's where I disagree with James Baldwin a little bit. It is doing what it's doing, and its significance comes in pushing certain themes and ideas and concepts that white audiences wouldn't have been that aware of, but black audiences probably would have been aware of. I think it's a very different novel than Uncle Tom's Cabin, actually. And I think Richard Wright has kind of escaped a lot of the sentiment that Baldwin accuses him of. But anyways, I'm getting off topic, and I don't even know how he quite got down that rabbit hole. But anyways, what happens in the rest of Flight? So he gets identified as the suspect, and then he's truly trying to escape. He's hiding out with Bessie, his girlfriend. Now, remember, he tried this scam before with the ransom letter. That helped expose him as the murderer. But at the time, he thought he could maybe blame the communists for this ransom letter, too, get a little bit of money, and use that to fund their getaway and new life somewhere else. Of course, that backfires on them. Now, Bessie has been a little suspicious of Bigger Thomas ever since Mary's murder, because remember, she saw him at the club with Mary, and then he's denying killing her. He's blaming Jan in front of her, but eventually she keeps asking questions, and he is forced to confess. He's forced to confess, and then, to keep her quiet, just kills her pretty unceremoniously. It's his second murder of the book. Now, it's an important murder because it does, of course, dig Bigger Thomas deeper into this realm of criminality, and it makes him essentially kind of a serial killer. But it's the fact that the media takes Bessie's murder or looks at it differently than Mary's murder, I think, is important. It's not as seen as an important. It's not even what he's being prosecuted for. He's being prosecuted for the rape and murder of Mary Dalton. And he didn't rape her. And the assumption is he did. Right? That's important. Now, he actually does commit sexual violence against Bessie. And that's not even considered. That's not even part of the media narrative about the treatment or his crimes. It's not even part of it. It's not even considered. So Bessie is neglected by the media as basically unimportant, the unimportant second victim of Bigger Thomas. Really, the only victim that matters is Mary. That's what he's on trial for. It's very clear that that's what he is. If he had just, I mean, that's a theme early in the book, too, is like, when they're holding up black-owned businesses, the police don't care, right? And then the question is, like, should we rob this white person? And Bigger Thomas is quite fearful that this will bring the attention of police down on him. So he backs out on this, and he doesn't do it. But that theme is established early in the book, and it's just paralleled here with the murders. Excuse me. So then we have a manhunt. Which show this shift in attention from Bigger Thomas being the servant, the kind of a faithful servant that wouldn't do this and was maybe manipulated and tripped by communists, but certainly not the criminal, to being monstrous, right? That shift happens overnight as soon as Bigger Thomas is identified. And I think that's an important point in this book. Here, reporters find Dalton girl's bones in furnace. Negro chauffeur disappears. 5,000 police surround Black Belt, the black neighborhoods of Chicago. Authorities hint sex crime. Communist leader proves alibi. Girl's mother in collapse. authorities hint sex crime is what he focuses on, right? Bigger Thomas thinks to this, to hint that he had committed a sex crime was to pronounce a death sentence. It meant wiping out his life before he was captured. It meant death before death came. For the white men who read those words would at once kill him in their hearts. End quote. So, again, no evidence of this, really. And then the whole black belt of Chicago gets targeted by the police. Thousands of police on this manhunt, targeting black neighborhoods, which are already, like, impoverished, rat-infested apartments. Like, I mean, that theme of Dalton, like, profiting off of this community is something that, you know, Richard Wright wants to, you know, emphasize here. And it actually gets brought up by Bigger Thomas's attorney in the trial later on. It's like, Dalton, you sort of made these conditions. You're profiting off of these conditions, and you charge more for poor quality apartments in this neighborhood because black people don't have any choice of anywhere else to live, right? And then they're being targeted by police violence. This is something that the recent adaptation emphasizes, where he is killed by the police instead of put on trial. He's just executed by the police. That makes sense in the context of Black Lives Matter and recent discourses about police violence. But I think you do lose something by not having the criminal trial, because you don't get Bigger Thomas's kind of reflection on his fate, right? The whole final third of this book is called Fate. And you miss that when you just have him killed by police. And you miss out on some of this media narrative, which is here. I don't know how much of this would translate in a modern setting. It couldn't translate entirely. This is really coming from that really nadir of race relations period where the media could just be openly racist towards a suspect like this. And towards the whole neighborhood, right? That basically gets besieged in the search for one person. So we have the murder of, and within a day, the media starts to go from sex crimes are hinted to headlines like 24-hour search fails to unearth rapist. Right? We also get raid 1,000 Negro homes, incipient Ryan quelled at 47th and Halstead. So there's evidence of social resistance to the police behavior here. But through this all, Bigger Thomas is hiding out. Eventually, he kills Bessie, of course, and then he's finally tracked down and captured. Now, what the police say as they capture him is, you know, confirms what Bigger Thomas was worried about, which was that he would be killed in white audiences' minds, including the police minds, before he was ever put on trial. Read this. There was a short step, and they started down the stairs with him, his head bumping along the steps. He folded his wet arms around his head to save himself. As soon as the steps had pounded his elbows and arms so hard that all of his strength left, he relaxed, feeling his head bounding painfully down the steps. He shut his eyes and tried to lose consciousness, but he felt it, drumming like a hammer in his brain. Then it stopped. He was near the street. He could hear shouts and screams coming to him like a roar of water. He was up in the street now, being dragged over snow. His feet were up in the air, grasped by strong hands. Kill him! Lynch him, that black son of a bitch! They let go of his feet. He was in the snow, lying flat on his back. Round him surged a sea of noise. He opened his eyes a little and saw an array of faces, white and looming. Kill that black ape! Two men stretched his arms out, and though about to crucify him, they placed a foot on each of his wrists, making him sink deep in the snow. His eyes closed slowly, and he was swallowed in darkness. That's how part two ends, with this virulent, racially violent words directed at Bigger Thomas by the people who capture him. And anyways, I was struck by the rapid shift in public perception towards Bigger Thomas in book two, and the lack of thoughtfulness about his conditions, his situation, and who he is as an individual. He goes from being a nobody to being this black ape. And we see this kind of reinforced in the media depictions of Bigger Thomas once he's arrested, like during his arraignment, where he's described as hunched over with the long arms, like this simian portrayal of it, which is obviously false, but it's what the media makes of it, right? It's what the media makes of him. So anyways, part three is called Fate. It's 150 pages. So we'll just talk about the first part of it, and then we'll finish up with the last part. And it's essentially a series of interviews between Bigger Thomas and various people, most importantly his lawyer, Mr. Max, this Jewish lawyer of the Communist Party, who is recruited by Jan to defend him. So we have those. We also have interviews, meetings between Bigger Thomas and his family. The Daltons at one point visit. And then we have like various hearings and records of various hearings, such as Bigger Thomas's trial, his the arraignment, and the interviews of witnesses throughout. Most importantly, Jan, but also the Daltons are interviewed, and the presentation of the evidence. And a big part of this whole book is, and here's where it does come off maybe a little bit like a protest novel, is where we have this long speech, basically, you know, hours long, a day long speech by Max, like basically Richard Wright on his soapbox, giving his theme of the book. And it works because we do have this trial setting, and Max knew that the only way to maybe let Bigger Thomas speak, maybe not save his life, but to let his voice, let his experience be known, is through this kind of speech. And of course, that's something maybe communists are prone to do. So I think it does come from the text. It comes from the story pretty organically, but it does feel that you're kind of beaten over the head with the theme of the book pretty directly. But I also think Richard Wright feels he has to do this in a way to pull it all together, because there's going to be things here that white audiences who he's trying to reach to a certain degree aren't going to be able to fully get their head around. Like, if you just read Fear, right, I think that's going to be, a lot of that is still going to kind of bounce off white audiences. And you need Max there to sort of explicate this stuff to the audience. Maybe readers now would be more sophisticated, less, come at the book with less racist assumptions. But at the time this was written, Mr. Max's role is sort of to be the communicator of the theme of the book, the explicator of the theme. All right, so we'll talk about all that next time. I guess that speech, that defense, Bigger Thomas's defense by Mr. Max. Now, the important thing here is book three is called Fate, of course, and that's Bigger Thomas's arc is accepting his fate, accepting that he's going to be going to die. We don't actually see that. It's just, all but. I mean, he's I think it's his last days by the end of the book. He will be put to death soon. Now, of course, you might be thinking of an American tragedy with this. American tragedy actually has something in common with this, in which we see someone. I did that a long time ago in this podcast, if you remember, Dreiser's novel, which also spends a lot of time. It's based on kind of real events, like this is based on a real serial killer that Richard Wright knew about. And you had the same kind of like public perception of him in the media. So that's kind of what he's riffing off of here. American Tragedy had that same kind of drawn from the headlines kind of story. And also a lot of time spent in jail and awaiting death row and all that kind of stuff. But same thing, kind of dealing with social conditions underneath it. I don't remember all the details of that book. I knew it was a little bit longer and a few more things going on there than maybe in this book, but not dealing with the racial component. But it has that same sort of feel of a long, prolonged trial after a tragic event. But the theme of this is established very early on of this book three. There was no day for him now. There was no night. There was but a long stretch of time, a long stretch of time that was very short, and then the end. Toward no one in the world did he feel any fear now. for he knew that fear was useless, and towards no one in the world did he feel any hate now, for he knew that hate would not help him. Though they carried him from one police station to another, though they threatened him, persuaded him, bullied him, and stormed at him, he steadfastly refused to speak. Most of the time he sat with his bowed head staring at the floor, or he lay full length upon his stomach, his face buried in the crook of the elbow, just as he lay upon the cot with the pale yellow sunshine of a February sky falling obliquely upon him through the cold steel bars of the 11th Street Police Station. So his life's over at this point. He knows there's no defense. This was established in part two, that the minute he was deemed a sex criminal, again, for the wrong person, for Mary and not for Bessie, his life is over. There's no defense that's going to be successful. He will be put to death. He knows this, and that's why he now doesn't feel fear anymore. Like, that inevitability of it, the acceptance of the fate is there. Now, the full development of that comes throughout book three, but right away we're told he's kind of already come to terms with his fate. And so what's the point of the rest of this? Well, partially it is to give the space for Richard Wright to explore, or to have Max make the defense, to clearly explicate the theme of the book. And I'll talk about that next time. But I think another interesting thing here is the media portrayal, is the presentation of it. Listen to this. So we actually get the full report of the inquest. Negro rapist fates as the inquest is the headline. And here's how he's described. Through the Negro killer's body does not seem completely compactly built. He gives the impression of possessing abnormal physical strength. He is 5 feet 9 inches tall, and his skin is exceedingly black. His lower jaw protrudes obnoxiously, reminding one of a jungle beast. His arms are long, hanging in a dangling fashion to his knees. It's easy to imagine how this man, in the grip of a brain-numbing sex passion, overpowered little Mary Dalton, raped her and murdered her, beheaded her, and then stuffed her body into the roaring furnace to destroy the evidence of his crime. His shoulders are huge, muscular, and keeps them hunched, as if about to spring upon you at any moment. He looks at the world with a strange, sullen, fixed from under stare, as though defying all efforts of compassion. All in all, he seems a beast utterly untouched by the softening influence of modern civilization. In speech and manner, he lacks the charm of average, harmless, gentle, grinning southern darky so beloved by the American people. The moment the killer made his appearance at the inquest, there were shouts of lynch him, kill him, but the brutish Negro seemed indifferent to his fate, as though inquest, trials, and even the looming certainty of the electric chair held no terror for him. He acted like an earlier missing link in the human species. He seemed out of place in white man's civilization. The Irish police captain remarked with deep conviction, "I am convinced that death is the only cure for the like of him." End quote. So this is really over the top stuff. I mean, it doesn't have place in journalism, obviously. It's the writer here just being as racist as he wants. It's almost like Bigger Thomas's crimes give him free license to be an unhinged racist in his writing. It has no journalistic function. It's just gross. And I think that's the point, partially, is like Bigger Thomas's crimes provide cover for the most odious racism in white society. Right, because they could tell themselves, as bad as we are, as racist as we are towards black people, as horrible as our civilization is, Bigger Thomas is worse. Right? In the same way, after like 9/11, you were able to have all this anti-Muslim, anti-Arab sentiment across the country. It's like 9/11 provided that cover for these racist ideas. At least that's kind of my take on it. Now, plot-wise, obviously it's just a lot of hearings and interviews with different people. And one big theme throughout this in the questioning of Bigger Thomas that comes up again and again, and here's kind of where I want to leave it, because it's something that's never really goes away as the novel develops, is this idea that somehow, like, yes, he's going to die for this, but we can also blame the communists, right? Like, the communists can also be blame for this. Jan is not the murderer, but how can we blame the communists in some way for this? And it comes through various questioning. Like one thought is like, did the communists promise you white women if you were to join the movement? Now, none of this really happens. Now, maybe somewhat subtly this is in Bigger Thomas's mind. In his discomfort at socially being with Mary and Jan, is that maybe, you know, he's thinking that this is crossing a line of intersociability across the races that I'm not comfortable with. And maybe in some way there's a hint, like, you can hang out with us and there'll be white women there. But never is that made explicit. And that's never really talked about. It's that we're an interracial organization. And you know, we support liberty for American blacks and whatever that means. And we do that through fighting for interracial socialization. There were communist parties tried to do that kind of thing in the United States. But from the police, the lawyers, from the prosecutor's point of view, it's like, you must have promised them white women. And that is what created the conditions for this tragedy, right? Now, he denies this, right? But, and then, of course, they're trying to push this idea that he raped her too, right? That the idea of raping Mary would have come from the communists promising things like that. Or the same thing with like the ransom note. It's like the communists must have set you up for that, right? Must have had you do that. So they want to make the communists, and Jan in particular, somehow an actor in the murder by giving him these ideas, right? That's part of it that's going on here. And that's one thing I think it's worth thinking about, right? So in the questioning of Jan, it's all about this. It's all about the racial politics of the Communist Party. Do you believe in social equality for Negroes? I believe all races are equal, Jan began. Answer yes or no, Mr. Erlone. You're not on a soapbox. Do you believe in social equality for Negroes? Yes. Are you a member of the Communist Party? Yes. In what condition did Miss Dalton when you left her last Sunday morning? What do you mean? Was she drunk? I would not say she was drunk. She had a few drinks. At what time did you leave her? I think it was 1:30. Was she in the front seat of the car? Yes. She had been in the front seat. Had she been in the front seat all along? No. Was she in the front seat when you left the cafe? No. Did you put her up in the front seat when you left the car? Now, what's going on here? Well, the front seat, of course, is where Bigger is. He's the driver. So the idea is like you got her drunk and then put her in the front seat next to Bigger, kind of as a gift almost to Bigger. And that's the implication of this whole line of questioning that they get. And even this, did you tell that drunken Negro to call you Jan instead of Mr. Alone? Like, are you promoting this social equality? Right, so the communists are being blamed not for the murder of Mary Dalton, but accused of offering up an alternative to the virulent racism of white society. Now, there's that whole strain. Now, Mr. Max tries to do his own kind of contextualization of the crimes, and he does that in the questioning of Mr. Dalton. And the questioning of Mr. Dalton by Max centers on, like, you know, by saying Jan's not the only one who influenced Bigger Thomas. You also influenced him by keeping him in a slum, and the social conditions of segregation are part of the social context as well. And that's kind of where I'm going to leave off today, because the trial goes into the social context of the crimes, which of course is set up in the first part of the book too, in our deep dive into Bigger Thomas's mind in the first part of the book. But it's just explicated by these lawyers. Again, is it the best way to do it? I don't know. I think it's pretty well done though. I've been trying to come to terms with James Baldwin's criticism of this book, and I'm not happy with it, but maybe I gotta wait. Maybe I gotta read more Richard Wright, because I still got two books of his to read after this. So I don't want to jump too far ahead in that direction, but we'll deal with that when we get to it, I guess. So anyways, that's it for now. I will finish up my thoughts about the book in the final episode covering Native Son next time. So anyways, in the meantime, let me know what you think of this book or its themes, and I look forward to talking with you next time. Thanks for listening.
And every night they sang in the pale moonlight. Oh, by gee, by gosh, by gum, by jaw. Oh, by jingo, won't you share our love? We will build for you a hut. You're gonna be our favorite nut. We'll have a lot of little, oh, by gollies. Then we'll put them in the follies.